Let's do our weekly check-in on the LG display situation with the Apple stores.
How have we managed to have 3 weeks worth of LG display news?
We're pivoting. This is all we do now. So what's the latest on LG's mystery display situation in the Apple Store?
Yeah, well, actually, this week we have some kind of resolution.
There's a box.
We have a new product actually out.
Yeah, so let's recap first. So a few weeks ago, I mean, the first thing that happened was that the 4K LG display that Apple sells, it's like the iMac 21.5-inch screen but without a computer in it, went away abruptly. And then the 5K one is like low on stock, but in Apple stores at least. But there was no 21.5-inch replacement. And so here we are now. What's new?
Yeah, so the 4K display has returned to the Apple Store with a new model. And instead of being 21.5 inches, it's now 23.7, which is a weird random diagonal, but there you go.
It's no longer the size of an iMac, yeah.
Yes, so it's going away from the iMac kind of display, you know, de facto put this here and put it next to it, and it's going more separate, differentiated. But it's kind of like a mixed bag of new and old. It still sells for the same price as the old 4K. It's $699, but the resolution's changed, and it's actually gone down incredibly.
It's less retina. I mean, for one, it's a bigger screen by, you know, 2.2 inches, so and having diagonally, the same resolution, so then if it's still the 4K display, then it's less retina than it was, because Apple was at that retina point, I guess, based on your distance from the screen. But they don't make like a 4K iMac that's 23.7 inches and call it the retina 4K iMac, so it's less so retina.
The PPI of a 21.5-inch iMac is like 218, mm-hmm. And obviously PPI is, you know, resolution divided by screen area. It gives you how many pixels per inch, literally. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And retina is this like kind of hand wavy term where it depends on the average viewing distance from the device, because obviously on a phone you hold your phone close to your eye, so the retina PPI needs to be higher. Like the iPhone 4 was 326 basically, but then the iPads, they always assume that you'd hold them further away, so the iPad retina has always been like 220, 250, that kind of range. Mm-hmm. The iMacs are like in the 218 range, and that's kind of the same for the MacBook Pros as well. This is standard 4K, like 3840 by blah blah blah, at 23.7 inches, which comes out to a PPI of just over 200. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit lower than the iMac, and obviously the 4K display before was the same as the iMac. It was 218 PPI, because it had like 4,096 by 2,304. Like, it was a bit beyond 4K, even though they called it the 4K panel, right. And it was smaller. So now you've got a bigger display and slightly less pixels on both dimensions, which leads to lower PPI.
How odd.
I don't quite understand why they've picked this one. I assume it must like save them money somewhere along the line, but people will appreciate that it'll probably be bigger, you know, like the screen's bigger. The more like coarseness in definition will be noticeable, but you'd probably have to be pretty picky about it, probably. Like, it always just depends on how far away you sit from it, right?
Yeah, and they still market this as the 23.7-inch display for Mac, like on the box, so they mean for this to be like the Apple display for in this price range. And you know, on the Apple Store website, I mean, that's on the box itself from LG. On the Apple Store website, they also show it with like MacBooks, and you know, if you buy a Mac Mini and you need a display, like, this is what you kind of start out with if you're in an Apple Store, unless you go somewhere else and have your own display, etc. Did Thunderbolt change about it too, or the port situation?
Yeah, the ports are different. So the old 4K display was just USB-C, and so it'd have one USB-C port for input, and then it would have like three peripheral ports, which are just like the lowest. Basically, the peripheral ports you're just meant to plug in like keyboard and mouse, like physical wired, you know, like low power accessories, and they can be funneled through USB-C. Yeah. And you'd have the one input port, which was actually where your display is coming in from. Mm-hmm. The new 4K display has two input ports, but they're Thunderbolt 3 ports.
Okay.
And you can only use one at a time, but the other one can be used for pass-through, so you can connect a Thunderbolt 3 accessory to the other one. So obviously one's only driving the actual display, and then the other one's spare for you to use for whatever you want. Plus, you still have the same three peripheral ports as well, which are just standard USB-C.
So you no could plug there, in, you get a gain, yeah.
Yeah, so you could plug in, like, keyboard, mouse, and maybe microphone into like the three USB-C, you know, wired ports, and then you could plug in a RAID array or maybe even another 4K display into that port, So you basically be daisy chaining a second 4K display through the first one. And obviously the benefit there is on your laptop, you're still only plugging in one cable at the end of the day. It's just right. sending both displays worth of, you know, information across one cable.
So in that regard, it's a little bit closer to the 5K display, which mm-hmm. has more Thunderbolt 3 ports on the back. Like, you don't think you worry about the, what the back is. I've done this with the iPad Pro. It, you know, it's got the USB-C port. So I plugged it into, because I have the 21.5-inch LG 4K display, the one that this replaces. And so I plugged it in with the USB-C cable to the iPad Pro to project what's on the iPad onto the LG display. And then I plugged in a USB-C to micro USB cable to my camera and imported photos that way just to like try that. Cause that was one of the images that Apple showed like as a demo of the iPad Pro with the USB-C and a display was like plug the camera up to the display and let it route through the USB-C cable that, you know, to the iPad. And it's like one cable plug into the iPad and does that. So I've tried that just for like, you know, science and it works. So I guess in this regard, like replace the iPad with a Mac with Thunderbolt 3, and then you've got that extra port there. The size thing is just so weird. Like in one regard, like bigger is nicer, but then the resolution changing is makes it not perfect. So
yeah, and it's not even like keeping the old dimensions of resolution just in a bigger screen. It's also actually, you know, having less pixels across the bigger area. Like it's a weird choice. They probably save money on it somewhere along the line.
Yeah,
but although the input ports are Thunderbolt 3, they're using a display port over USB-C for the input, so you can, it's still compatible with the iPad Pro,
which is handy.
Yeah.
And I think after this story went live, we had – so we were kind of – I think we like received a tip about this monitor before, and we mentioned it on the show, and we were like, it could just be like a rebranding of an existing one because they use this ultrafine for a lot of different things now. So we didn't run that story, but we ran the story whenever a Tidbits author received this display from ordering an the 4K version from the Apple store, and this is what they were given. They were like, this is new. And then the next day, the listing went up on Apple's website, so it's like now it's official. You know, and there's all clarity here because it wasn't even on LG's website yet. But then after that, we received another tip that we haven't ran because it's in that same category of unknown. But someone saying that there's a revision to the 5K display coming too.
Yeah, and that would apparently add support for the iPad Pro by being a dual Thunderbolt 3 and USB-C
input. Right, yeah. And I think I heard that like there might be some marketing campaign from LG this summer, so, like July timeframe. So it's all coming together, but we're not at the end of this yet.
Yeah, because I mean the big thing with the iPad Pro is Apple, you know, unveiled it boasting that it could drive displays up to 5K resolution over the USB-C port, but it hasn't sold a compatible 5K display. And they're very, very thin on the ground if you're looking elsewhere too, like basically impossible. So it would be nice if Apple does have one, and it seems like it's coming soon-ish, although not at the moment. Again, it's going to be like some staggered rollout where they do the 23-inch one first.
Yeah.
The rumors about like external display support on the iPad improving as well might tie into that. Like maybe they can, you know, announce iOS 13, they can talk about the iPad features with external display and be like, and we're also, you know, it's a nice compliment to then actually be able to sell a 5K display that actually works with the iPad Pro.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see. I guess we're a couple weeks away and we'll see what happens there. The other big story this week is, this is the big story this week. Apple has new MacBook Pros out, and it's less than a year since the last update. And there's an aspect of this about the keyboard, but Apple had a whole announcement just about the MacBook Pros. And then the keyboard news was all through like a support document plus like private press briefings. But recap, what's new in the 2019 MacBook Pro lineup?
Not much.
Yeah.
They basically improved the processors and then tweak the keyboard. The 13-inch, notably the non Touch Bar 13-inch MacBook Pro, again, received no updates. Like when they did the 2018 MacBook Pro update, they pointedly said there was no update at the moment for the non-Touch Bar MacBook Pro. That continues to be the case today with this revision. So that's kind of like in the wings of, you know, what's it going to do? Are they going to spec bump it at some point? The 13-inch MacBook Pro with Touch Bar has slightly spec bump processors. And when I say slightly, I mean slightly, because it's like 0.1 gigahertz on both of the base configurations. They keep the same price, but you know the jump in performance is very, very small, and it's still the old generation. So basically the same MacBook Pro that you could buy last year with the same Intel chip inside is still what's sold today in the 13.
Yeah, it's a faster version of the 8th generation Intel chips.
Yeah, in a barely faster version.
Yeah, slightly.
And I believe that Intel is yet to supply chips at the required power wattage for that form factor. So these are technically still the fastest chips Apple, and the most new chips Apple could put in the chassis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like they're like holding it away just because they're being mean. The Intel chips are unavailable.
But a 13-inch MacBook Pro from last July or this week is nearly the same.
Yeah.
Yeah,
essentially.
But the 15-inch models are much more different.
The 15-inch models now have an 8-core option, and that's enabled by 9th generation Intel processors, which are actually very, very new to the market. Like
last month, I think, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. For a while, you know, the big complaint with the Mac line was Apple was either being really, really slow to adopting CPU generations or actually skipping them entirely. There were a few years in, you know, the 2015 timeframe, 2016 timeframe, where it felt like they'd let like a whole generation of CPU go by without an update at all, and it was very weird. And some people like to blame Intel for that and their delays, and other people blame Apple. The reality is probably somewhere in between. But in this case, at least, they are actually adopting the latest gen processors as fast as they effectively could. Like, there are almost no Windows laptops out right now that use the 9th gen process either, because they are just like hot off the press.
Yeah, and this is a fast turnaround too, because I mean, they were revised after WWDC last year, so it was in July, like the middle of July. And that was a big update, because it was not just the new processors, it was also True Tone Display for the first time, and the T2 chip in the MacBook Pro for the first time.
Yeah.
So it went from T1 to T2, which meant it also worked with voice-activated Siri. And so that was more than just a speed boost. It was also some other features. And this time it's just a speed boost, but it wasn't...
And in October of last year, they added that extra GPU option as well.
Yeah, they had a higher-end GPU option in October. Last year's July update in the MacBook... For the 13-inch, it was the first time they had quad-core, right? And then it was the first time they had 6-core in the 15-inch. And now this is the first time we've got 8-core less than a year later. And is that now Intel makes these chips in this configuration, so they're adopting them, you know, as fast as they could, and they think they can handle it? Whereas, like, that's just why they didn't have this before?
Well, the 8-core laptop chips just didn't exist before, so that's why they're around now.
Yeah.
But whether they can handle it is a...
I guess we'll see.
Yeah, it's an open question.
Because wasn't the quad core, or what was it that had the heat issue where people were putting them in fridges? Was that last summer?
That was the 6-core i9, which was the top spec one last year. Because last year basically what is now the 8-core in the lineup was the 6-core, right? It was like the higher end 15-inch configuration.
Yeah, you can now spend even more money on a MacBook Pro, right?
Yeah, and so that came out, and people found that it was suffering from heavy thermal throttling. Like, it couldn't sustain running 6-core simultaneously for very long at all.
Yeah.
Apple released a software update that, because apparently that it was like the firmware was configured wrong, which it did significantly improve the situation. But, you know, all of these laptops suffer from thermal constraints. You know, they're mobile laptops, and they're very thin laptops at that. So it's not like, you know, even anyone's computer will thermal throttle at some point. It's just, is it doing it so quickly that having the extra cores is pointless?
And we're still on the track where they're adding more cores to make it much faster, but not that the chips are more efficient to be much faster, more performant? Is that
right? The 9th generation chips are Coffee Lake improved. I think that's what Intel calls them. So they're still Coffee Lake, but they're supposedly slightly more efficient. But it's not like dramatically different, right? It's not an architecture. It's not like a fabrication leap.
Okay.
The i9 you get is 8-core, which is 2.4 gigahertz, and then it turbo boosts up to 5 gigahertz.
Which is the first in the MacBook Pro.
So that's the most powerful MacBook Pro you can buy at the moment.
Right.
The 5 gigahertz turbo boost is like, if the computer is in a decent thermal state, it can overclock itself up to the 5. Its baseline is 2.4, but, you know, if you're lucky, you'll get up to 5. And what tends to happen in practice is that it sits at 2.4, and then, you know, every few minutes it can boost to 5 for, you know, a minute, and then it's too hot, so it can't do it anymore.
Yeah, and if you've got a workload where you want to run as fast as possible for as long as possible, then it shouldn't be a mobile laptop. It should be a desktop with a much better cooling system,
like the iMac Pro.
Or maybe even better than the iMac Pro, like, you know, modular Mac Pro in a few weeks, maybe.
Sure, yeah. Yeah. It's hard to judge, and obviously nobody's got these yet because they only came out yesterday.
Yeah.
Whether adding this model will make a significant difference or not. Apple says in some workloads you get up to twice as fast. It varies dramatically depending on what you're doing. But it all depends on, you know, if you're doing something that's a sustained task over a long period of time, you know, all of these chips are going to thermal throttle down. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, you're probably going to see the same performance you did with the previous generation.
Yeah.
If you're doing work that is computationally intensive but more bursty, you know, like, oh, I need a lot of computation for 5 seconds and then more write for a minute, and I'm doing another high, heavy computation for 5 seconds. At that point, you're like smoothing out the heat dissipation. So you should end up being in turbo boost for longer and using all 8 cores at full power,
mm-hmm.
thereby being more performant.
Yeah. These will probably be very hot computers at the high end. When you spend the $6,000 for the 8-core models with all the specs bumped up, they'll probably be very warm to use, to touch.
Yeah, I have to say, there's like two options for the i9, for the new ninth gen's i9s. The base model is 2.3 boosting up to 4.8, and then for $200 more you get 2.4 bursting up to 5.0. I feel like the upgrade there is just like falsehood. Like, it's like such a small difference in like gigahertz. I really doubt
it's all like theoretical in terms of what you hit consistently.
Yeah, like I think the big bonus comes from having two extra cores, right? Like, mm-hmm. you're essentially speeding up two extra worth of threads that can be running at the same time. Mm-hmm. Having the gigahertz of those cores be, you know, 0.1 gigahertz faster than the base model probably isn't going to see a change. Like, the biggest dramatic improvement you'll get is going from a 6-core to an 8-core, not an 8-core that's slightly faster than the other 8-core.
Right, yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And all of this, before you even get to the keyboard situation, is weird because, like you said, there's no new 13-inch MacBook Pro with non-touch bar. That one is, like, wasn't that WWDC 2016 or 2017?
2017, 2 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah, it's approaching on 2 years now. Like, as of WWDC, it'll be 2 years when that MacBook, 12-inch MacBook came out, and the 13-inch MacBook Pro without touch bar. It was like a big Mac update at that event. And then the next year, we did get the MacBook Pros after WWDC last year, but no MacBook at all last year, no MacBook Pro with non-touch bar last year, and then no iMacs last year. Those came this year in March. And I've seen a lot of people think that the iMacs are new this week just because it was like such low fanfare whenever it happened before the March 25th event. And they saw the new label on them. But the iMac situation is okay right now in terms of, like, it got a spec boost. The MacBook Pro is, but the 12-inch MacBook is old now, and that
long
is
in the tooth.
Yeah, and that is a machine that I think is still like the nicest, like, portable Mac, and if you just want like a nice design and like body, you don't care about the speed so much. But that's a machine where I don't know what the chips have been doing, but every chip improvement it could take is noticeably better because it is so slow. That, like, they've made 3 versions of them so far, and each one has been better than the last one by a lot because of where it started out. And maybe they're just waiting for, like, you know, their switch to ARM, and that's going to be their first ARM Mac. I don't know. But then it's also, like, what are they doing with the non-touch bar MacBook Pro? Like, why continue to sell those if they're not going to update them? And so they must be updating them eventually, but when? Like, what are they waiting for? And if we can go, like, the 13-inch MacBook Pro gets a 0.1 gigahertz increase year, you know, under a year, then I'm not sure what their strategy is there with the MacBook and the non-touch bar MacBook Pro.
Yeah, the ARM, like, the whole 12-inch MacBook waiting for ARM, maybe, but it feels like there's a long timeline there of they probably could have fitted in one more, you know, Intel-based update for it before the ARM mm-hmm. transition. There's a very, very slim chance that they do an ARM Mac this year, maybe in the fall with, you know, macOS 10.15. But most people, you know, most publications believe that the ARM transition is starting, you know, 2020, 2021. So to leave the 12-inch without an update for 2 years seems a bit excessive, and maybe even 3 years just seems ridiculous. So I don't really know why that one's hanging around like,
and you
know,
to like still sell it for $1,300 is, yeah.
Yeah. The non-touch bar MacBook Pro being left alone again is at least explained by the availability of the Intel chips, because obviously the 13-inch with touch bar got such minor updates anyway. It was basically a no update, like we just mentioned, with the 0.1 gigahertz improvement. So at that point, it's like, well, you can see why they didn't bother touching the non-touch bar one. The 12-inch is more of a puzzle.
Yeah, yeah. And then all of this, again, before we get to the keyboard situation, is that there is this rumored 16-inch MacBook Pro that we haven't rolled out for this year, at least. Like, we wouldn't think it would be this month, but it would be like September, October, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, Quo said it was a... You know, the whole report came from Quo, and he said it was for this year. So
yeah, and there was the follow up report that people misreported from translation, that people thought that meant delayed. But then we waited to report on it when we had the English version, and it wasn't that it was delayed. It was that a future version will use a new screen technology, but it made no difference in the timeline of the first version of that 16-inch MacBook Pro, which we think will be redesigned and make different choices than the current MacBooks. But it certainly sounds like if that does come this year. I mean, it won't replace the 15-inch MacBooks because they're just now being updated. So it will be probably an even higher-end model in the lineup that maybe you could spend more on a super high-end 15-inch MacBook Pro, but that there will be the starting price for the 16-inch MacBook Pro with a new design will probably be much higher than starting price for the base 15-inch model, I would guess.
Yeah, or like it's however much the high-end 15-inch configuration is now – that's the price of the redesigned one, but you're getting lower base specs for,
right,
so you
right.
know, you're paying for the new design as part of it.
And I would say, like, if you're in the market for a powerful MacBook Pro right now, it's probably a good time to wait, because we're on, like, what, the third or fourth version, probably the fourth version of these MacBook Pros since 2016. And there's this big 16-inch rumor, like, that it could come this year. So
yeah, and historically, the MacBook Pro gets, you know, chassis redesigned every 4 years, like 2012, 2016. So we're definitely bumping up on the chassis redesign. Like, and that's what I'm waiting. I'm on the 2016 MacBook Pro. I'm not going to be too fussed about anything until they do the chassis again, especially as it sounds like, you know, they're going to do the bezel-less look. It's going to look a lot prettier, and they're going to do, you know, some rather fundamental changes. So I'm definitely just waiting it out. Like, I don't have any rush to, you know, buy spec bump versions.
Right. Yeah. So I think that a lot of people, if you've got the 2016 MacBook Pro or newer, like, you, there's, and you just got to really need a portable MacBook right now to buy the 15-inch model, even though it is like the fastest one yet, just because it could be later this year that we have like a majorly different version of it that is way more appealing.
You know? Yeah. And there was like this kind of like outside hope that the 16.5-inch would be, you know, maybe announced at WWDC or something. Now that these ones have been announced now, it's clear that's not going to happen.
Yeah, so, it feels like it's got to be a fall thing if it happens to be this.
It's got to be fall at the earliest now, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It could be later, but it's fall at the earliest. And that computer might have a different keyboard style than this. Like, it could be thicker and heavier, you know, slightly, and have a different keyboard. But they've changed the keyboard in this model of MacBook Pro, and they've expanded the keyboard repair program to include this MacBook Pro, even with its changed keyboard. So what they say about the keyboard is that it's got new materials in the switch mechanism. And this isn't like from Apple, the marketing page, but they briefed a lot of publications on what they did. So they explained it ahead of time. And they think that by using a new material, whatever that means, will fix the issue with sticky keys and keys having like repeated characters or just not responding to clicks. And a lot of the headlines were like Apple's fixed the keyboard, like based on their briefing, but this is the third generation of Butterfly keyboard, and it's the second version of the third generation.
And yeah, the last two.
Yeah, the last version, they didn't say it. They said that the last version was quieter to type on externally, but internally they had notes that said they had the silicon membrane layer included to keep debris from getting in the keyboard and having, you know, the keys get stuck that way. So that was a big change too. I mean, they added a material there. This time they've tweaked the material, so it's the same keyboard generation, but it does have a change. But I think, I mean, in a major way, if you had a problem with the third generation keyboard from the last MacBook Pro and the current MacBook Air, then we don't know. New material is so vague that, like, you just have to wait and see. You can't take that. Like, I feel like that the membrane layer was more promising than new material. But if the material was the problem, then I guess we'll see. And it'll be kind of surprising if it's like all resolved, The big thing here for me is that you don't have to have a 2019 MacBook Pro to try out the new keyboard, because they've also expanded the repair program to include the 2018 MacBook Pro and the 2018 MacBook Air, which is the currently selling MacBook Air, you know, and the new MacBook Pro, like the one that you buy today, it's also in this repair program. So you get a free keyboard repair if you feel like you need it within 4 years of purchase. But if you have the last MacBook Pro from 2018 July or the current MacBook Air and you get the keyboard replaced for free, then you get the new keyboard with the new material, which is the first time that you get a keyboard repair and you kind of upgrade your keyboard to
that's why they've specifically said it is not a new generation, right? Because the like my 2016 MacBook Pro, I haven't bothered to get it to do the keyboard service program on it yet, because it's like, well, if they're just going to replace it with the same generation of keyboard, I know it's going to exhibit the same problems. So there's
just reset the clock on how long until it starts to have an issue.
Yeah, pretty much. And as we've talked about in the show before, I definitely have repeated key problems, but it's not persistent. Like, it doesn't last forever. So you just kind of like ride the storm, and then the repeated key goes away, and then a few days later or a few weeks later, you get a different repeated key or a different stuck key. Like, I kind of just go through the cycles of that, and it's like, you know, I'll put up with that rather than like sending my laptop away and then getting it back, and then, you know, in a month or so, doing exactly the same thing. The fact that now they even announced, like, publicly that the turnaround times are going to be 24 hours or less, you know, they're going to dramatically improve the turnaround time, which we'd seen from the Apple support documentation, but they actually addressed that officially
in the press briefings at least, right?
Yeah. That's nice, and it definitely makes me more interested in doing it, but again, if the generation's not changing, then what's the point? So here, you know, the reason they're still calling it third generation, not fourth generation, is because it applies to the 2018 version as well. So that's why it's third generation new materials, not calling it a fourth gen. Mm-hmm. In terms of my confidence of it being fixed, you've got to think that, you know, the kings of industrial design surely are not going to come out. It wasn't in the press release, and it's not on like the marketing pages, but I don't think they would have talked us to press about it if they didn't have a reasonable expectation that they actually think it's going to reduce the problem. What we'll probably see is the percentage go down. Mm-hmm. The problem is, does it go down a lot, or does it only go down by half? Because I feel like if it only went down by half, and only half as many people have problems with the third generation Take Two as they did before, that's still going to be a very sizable number. It'll help Apple's, you know, return rates and stuff, and I'm sure, you know, halving that's great. But
yeah, I'm hoping the teardown makes this make more sense, because, you know, it's like. To redesign it would be like, okay, it's a different design, so it makes different choices. Maybe that fixes it. But it feels like this design, like, no matter what you do with the keys, that this, like, the size of everything and how close it is together is a big part of it. And I don't know, like, you know, one of the theories is that they changed the spring in some way. But it's just so vague that I just don't have a lot of confidence in it. And unless the teardown is like super revealing and just like, this is like what happened and why it was a problem, and now it's not.
Well, you know, with the iPhone 6S, they made the aluminium 7000 series instead of whatever weaker aluminium they were using before. That is essentially a change of materials, and that noticeably improved the whole Bendgate situation of that year.
That makes sense. You make it bends, you make it stronger, it doesn't bend as easily. If the problem is that the least bit of debris, you run out of physical space, then you need more physical space to accommodate like a physical debris without having an issue.
Yeah, I guess the issue is if a piece of dust gets in the way, then a new material isn't going to make a piece of dust not get in the way.
Unless the new material is like less volume, but then I'm just not convinced, like, by logic that this makes sense yet.
Yeah, it definitely needs testing in the field before you trust it blindly.
And it's quite a tall claim. Like, I think my biggest thing is, journalistically, I wouldn't say Apple fixed the keyboard situation based on the briefing. And a lot of headlines said that. But also, even so, like, even if you say Apple claims to, then you've got to really be skeptical, because it is Take 4, even though it's third generation, it's the second version of third generation. So it is Take 4 on this keyboard. So, the verdict is very much out, in my opinion.
I did see quite a lot of snarkiness about the fact that the 2019 are already on the repair program, and, like, mm-hmm. you know, Apple can't have much faith in this keyboard. It's already on the AppleCare support, you know, cycle. I actually disagree with that. Like, I think it's like a good symbolic gesture to be saying, you know, even if you're skeptical about us actually fixing the problem, if you buy the 2019 one, there will be no ambiguity. It's on the same keyboard service program, and you can get your keyboard switched out, and the Apple Store geniuses will know what to do. You won't have to go through the normal Apple Care warranty channel and, like, have a battle with them about anything. You can just go to the keyboard service program process and get, you know, free keyboard repairs.
So, and that's part of the fast turnaround time between the last MacBook and this MacBook. Like, if they only added the 2018 MacBook Pro to the program and not the 2019 MacBook Pro, then it would be like, you always want to get the last version of the MacBook Pro because you get a better warranty that way than if you buy the brand new one. Because then
like at the end of last year, mm-hmm. if you had keyboard problems, you were getting better service on the 2017 model than the 2018 model. Just because the 2018 model hadn't yet been added into the official program, you'd have to go through normal warranty, you know, claims.
Yeah, right. So now it's like it's officially part of the program. There's no questions asked. Like, when I sent my MacBook in for the keyboard repair, like, I did that by mail, just by, you know, proximity. There's not an Apple Store close enough to make it convenient to go back and forth. So I did by mail, and there was no interaction. Like, so what's the problem, or prove it, or anything like that. It was just like, I sent it in, and then they sent it back to me with a, you know, whole new keyboard. I imagine at this rate, like, that's probably what the whole service is like. It's not like, which key is having problems? And it's like, not today. They're probably just like, okay, you know, in and out, you know.
Yeah. And to stress, if you have a 2018 MacBook Pro or a 2018 MacBook Air, definitely do this, because you're actually getting something different.
Yeah. You get a materially different keyboard in Apple's own words. So, and it's free for not just the first year, but for the four years from the purchase date. So, you know, you can still go and buy the MacBook Air brand new today, and you could reasonably request a new keyboard soon after that, I think.
Yeah, like with mine, because the generations don't change with my replacement, I'm not rushing to get it done, but I will get it replaced before the 4 years expires, if I happen to still be having the laptop by then, because I bought one in late 2016, so I've got until, you know, late 2020 to actually take advantage of the program. But until then, I'm just biding my time.
Yeah, the only catch to the keyboard repair program, I think the keyboard repair program is great because it's 4 years, and that's without adding Apple Care to it, which only gives you what, up to 3-4 years, like maybe 3 years max.
It's 2 years, isn't it? Like, AppleCare default is one, then you add plus, and isn't that an extra one?
I think it's 3 years for a Mac.
Okay. But, yeah, I literally never buy AppleCare. I'm like, not
on that stuff. I've got it on my iMac Pro because it's refurbished, so it seems like it was a good idea. But anyway, so it's 4 years versus, you know, for the MacBook keyboard repair program, so it's longer than even the longest warranty. And to buy a new MacBook Pro today, like, if you just don't care about the 16-inch rumor out there, and you're just like, I want a 15-inch MacBook Pro with a lot of speed and power, like, then you've got confidence that if the keyboard's a problem, then you'll at least get service, you know, in the year 2022. Like, you know, you're not going to be out of luck then. So I think that's great. But the only catch to all of it is that if you have other problems, like, I'm not sure what the problems would be, but, like, if there's other things that might need to be repaired, that comes first for the keyboard. Like, that's in the print of the support document. Of, like, there may be a cost associated if there's a repair. You can't say, like, I don't want to have that repaired, I just want the keyboard repaired. Because they can say, well, you've got to have this thing repaired, which will cost some money, and then we'll do your keyboard. I guess it's a liability that if there's already something wrong here, they don't want to make it worse or be blamed for it. So that's the only catch in all of it, is that if there's another problem that they see, then they will ask you to pay for that before you get your free keyboard repair or, you know, fix. So, but other than that, it at least, I think the whole like, keyboard situation is, it can feel overblown because like functionally, like we've had these keyboards for since 2016 and we've never not been able to use them, but we do experience the stiff keys where it does get aggravating. And I think you've had it worse than me where you can't even type in a password correctly because of the repeating characters. But hopefully this is the beginning of the end because it's such a boring topic and I'd be glad for it to go away. You probably think cybercrime is something that happens to other people and no one wants your data or that hackers can't grab your passwords or credit card number, but you'd be wrong. Stealing data from unsuspecting people on free public Wi-Fi is one of the simplest and cheapest ways for hackers to make money. When you leave your internet connection unencrypted, you might as well be writing your passwords and credit card numbers on a huge billboard for the world to see. That's why we recommend taking back your privacy and protecting yourself by using ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN secures and anonymizes your internet browsing by encrypting your data and hiding your public IP address. ExpressVPN has easy-to-use apps that run seamlessly in the background of your computer, phone, and tablet. And turning on ExpressVPN protection only takes one click. Using ExpressVPN, I can safely surf on public Wi-Fi without being snooped on or having my personal data stolen. For less than $7 a month, you can get the same ExpressVPN protection that we have. ExpressVPN is rated the number one VPN service by TechRadar and comes with a 30-day money-back guarantee. Protect yourself and your online activity today and find out how you can get 3 months free at expressvpn.com/happyhour. That's expressvpn.com/happyhour. For 3 free months with a 1 year package. Visit expressvpn.com/happyhour to learn more. Our thanks to ExpressVPN for sponsoring 9 to 5 Mac Happy Hour. All right, Mayor, the next thing this week is Apple did a press release before the press release about the MacBook Pro about Apple News Plus and a new feature it got last week. And it was a very long press release with lots of words, but the only thing mentioned in it was a fairly minor feature that was added a week prior to the press release. So tell me about the News Plus news this week, sort of.
Yeah, it was definitely a weird press release. So the feature started its life as a bullet point in the iOS 12.3 release notes, and it's a very minor feature. But I think what's happened is Apple wanted to bring some attention to News Plus, improve the PR around it a bit, and they kind of used this feature as an excuse to make a blog post out of it. So the feature is the fact that on the catalog screen now, there are buy button, there are follow buttons on the actual magazine covers. So one of the many complaints with News Plus when it came out is that it was actually really complicated to know that if you wanted to follow a specific magazine, what would you do? And the you know, following a magazine and adding it to your collection should be something that's really straightforward and simple. Right. But for whatever reason, Apple made it really difficult. Now it's easier. I still wouldn't say it's perfect, but it's better. So before, you'd have to like click on the magazine, then you'd have to click on the logo in like the navigation bar, which wasn't obvious that it's clickable, but it is. And then you would get the heart icon in the toolbar that you could click, and then liking it in the UI would mean follow. Now there's just a blue follow button on the covers themselves that you can tap directly and it will say following. And so it's a lot more direct at actually following a magazine.
It's closer to texture, you know, what you'd get from the service that News Plus replaces.
Closer to any sane application.
Yeah. So,
like when you follow someone on Twitter, you don't have to like dive through their profile picture. You just click follow and it does it.
Click their profile picture, like their tweets, and then you follow them.
Yeah. And following a magazine is nice in that it allows you to actually get to your favorite magazines faster by going to the News Plus tab, but it also marks it to be automatically downloaded for offline. So by pressing follow, the news app downloads those magazine issues passively in the background so that if you are in a place of no internet, you can actually still read the magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because unlike books, for instance, you don't download them explicitly. You just set them as following and then it automatically downloads them in the background. You know, you can't like manually say download this, download this, download that. It just kind of does it by itself. So following is a fundamental part of, you know, making that work. So
it's like free. It's like subscribe. But
yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So now that that's more apparent, presumably some level of customer satisfaction improved and less people be confused about how do they follow something.
And it's kind of what we discussed, which is that News Plus, you know, you can't subscribe because you're UK, but I didn't subscribe after the trial because there's the value there for me is questionable, but the UI alone is not where it needs to be a good service yet. And we framed it as that's what Apple Music was like at launch. And between iOS 8.4 and iOS 10, it got a lot better. And it was gradual before it was a major upgrade. And then now it's like unrecognizable to what it launched as. And we think News Plus will do that too. This is like baby step one of that process.
Yeah. And then the rest of the press release is kind of indirectly admitting that it didn't come out the gate perfectly.
Right.
So there was obviously the UI complaints. And then there was the complaints from publishers about, you know, Apple News format being annoying. And then there being it being hard to make Apple News content. And it's not being surfaced well enough and like promoted. So part of this press release is quotes from a few publications talking about how News Plus is helping them reach new audiences and how they're using Apple News format to make more interesting designs. So there's at least on the marketing side, they're ticking off that box, right? And then there's a really interesting quote from Eddie Q, which directly addresses the kind of like Apple side of the equation as far as the interface are concerned. And incredibly, he says that hundreds of people at Apple across editorial, engineering, marketing, and design are working to make Apple News Plus the best experience for people who love reading their favorite titles and stories. Hundreds is a lot of people. Maybe yeah. It's hundreds that also do other jobs. Like, I'm sure they don't have hundreds of people just working on News Plus. Like, the designers will also be designing other things. Still, is like, you know, it's kind of like an admission of, we know that the current state of the news app and News Plus is not good enough, and we are working to make it, you know, good and better. And we've got our eye on the ball, even if we don't want to come out the gate and admit it straight up.
Like, Apple doesn't boast how many engineers, marketing people, designers, and there's not really, there's editorial for the App Store, but they don't boast those numbers for any other service. But they've now put it in a press release for News Plus. And I don't think there's any other way to take it than how we take it, which is, yeah, they want to communicate. We're working on it. It's a work in progress. And we've got the people on it. I'm not sure you can interpret it any other way.
Yeah. And of course, this press release would normally be prime candidate for including, you know, numbers on how many people have subscribed in the first month or whatever. But, you know, new Apple doesn't like telling anyone any numbers. So there are no numbers shared about, you know, actual success of the service.
Right.
But I'm looking forward to it improving, and I'm sure it will. Whether that'll be this year or, you know, or next year, depending on their cycle of OS releases, or maybe even mid-cycle. Like, all these services, they care about to get them better. So it might be a thing where every point update or every other point update, there's like gradual improvements to News Plus, and then maybe by OS 14, they do like a visual, you know, redesign of the navigation, something like that.
Yeah, I'm sure that iOS 13 in a couple of weeks is way too soon to expect anything major. Like, there might be some visual stuff that's tweaked about it just to mesh with iOS 13 itself. You know, maybe there's dark mode support in there. But I would not think that it's we get the big change in iOS 13, but maybe in like iOS 13.1 or 13.2, you know, 6 months out, then those are the versions that could have, you know, they focus on the services apps. And then, like you said, when I was 14, then you've got plenty of time to do something much more major.
Yeah, like the news app in macOS 10.15 will probably get the ability to have multiple windows open just because that's going to be a feature of the Marzipan platform itself.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of like specifically responding to the feedback out the gate, you know, Apple got that feedback in the first week from March 25th, and that turnaround time to June early June is simply not long enough for them to actually do anything major there. Like the iOS 13 betas start getting like frozen at the start of May. So, you know, yeah. You basically have a month to, and the kind of changes that I want to see from the news app are like fundamental reorganization, you know, changing just main screen, tab bar, sidebar to like something more structural and actually promoting the content, not just having this sidebar that has everything jumbled up amongst each other. So those kind of changes will take longer, and so the earliest realistically you're going to see those is like the iOS 13.1 time frame, and maybe even later than that.
Yeah, and the press release, so Apple's newsroom press releases, they always have usually two people attached, their names are signed to the press releases, and that they're in charge of putting it together, and it's their team that they're involved with, you know, in terms of like PR people. And I had one name that was familiar to me that does stuff with podcasts, and I've met the person before. The first name attached with though was unfamiliar to me, so I looked it up, and the person began at Apple in March, like February, March. I think it was actually March. So like there was the March 25th event where Apple News Plus gets revealed. Like it's been in production for a few months, and they bought Textures like a year in the making. But the person who handles the PR for News Plus was hired in March, and they came from Vox, which was the first publication mentioned in the press release. So I thought that was very, very tidy. but I mean, they say, you know, they're putting the team together, I suppose. And so the editorial part of News Plus is like, or news in general, is that they've already had, you know, Apple only employees from the news world that do the curation stuff, you know, in the news app that's not the paid stuff. And the paid stuff is just like magazines that are sourced, you know, from publications. So they're at least growing the team. I thought that was a neat tidbit. Like if you look at the press release, the first name there is as new as the service itself. And so
that name is one of the hundred.
one of the hundreds, right. Let's go through the headlines this week too. So we had a few other news stories that aren't major topics, but we'll get to them. FTC, that's the Federal Trade Commission in the U.S. They've got movement against Qualcomm. What happened there this week?
Yeah, this is the judgment from, there was obviously the court case that was in like January time, and that was where Apple testified, and there was some back and forth about, you know, who, even though it was really the FTC's case. The judgment for that case has now been released, and it weighs heavily against Qualcomm, basically saying that they need to change their practices on every single point, which kind of validates Apple's arguments about Qualcomm being, you know, manipulative and anti-competitive if, you know, the government is ruling with the FTC and saying they did violate it. Qualcomm's being forced to make these changes about how they do their business. Of course, they're appealing, so this stuff will take, you know, years to actually resolve. But it definitely seems like a case where Qualcomm has been shown to be in the wrong. What impact this has on Apple is probably nothing now, because they already settled. And back when they settled in the March-April timeframe, they wouldn't have known the outcome of this ruling unless
they got cornered by 5G, and they had to settle too soon, and now I think there's a lot of reporting that like the new requirements to Qualcomm that will probably be initiated if the appeal is you know doesn't work out for Qualcomm, that Apple's deal anyway won't be affected by it.
Yeah, because it already separates chip supply and patents, which is one of the points on the sheet.
Right.
What it does mean is that in 6 years, when the current Apple deal expires, the market should be quote unquote healthier for them in terms of actually negotiating on fair rates. So, but for the short term, they've already settled. So kind of irrelevant.
Yeah. But other than that, Qualcomm literally has to renegotiate licensing terms as it relates to modem chips, which is pretty big deal. I think Apple won't be affected because they already basically did that just now. But for any other agreements, it sounds like there's going to be, you know, it's a lot of work. So wasn't a good day for Qualcomm. It was kind of a win for Apple, except that it doesn't change anything for Apple anymore. If they hadn't settled, it would be like evidence in their corner, I suppose. But
yeah, I think Apple would have been happier if this judgment had come 2 months sooner.
Yeah, totally. All right. And the next thing is, in Canada, it appears that the ECG function that just spread to a lot of places in Europe will finally be there on the Apple Watch in Canada. Why is that?
With iPhone in Canada blog found the Health Canada database, which basically lists you know, regulations and thing, and devices have been approved. They found that Health Canada had signed off on the ECG app and irregular heart rate rhythm notifications as soon as the 16th of May, which is rather awkwardly the exact same day that WatchOS 5.2.1 came out. And it seems like Apple has to release software updates to expand the geographic applicability of the ECG app. Like, 5.2.1 actually added ECG for countries like Hungary. It just seems like Canada was slightly too slow, so it'll probably come out whenever WatchOS 5.3 ships.
Yeah, so 5.2 was the software update that where you got ECG app, right? Mm-hmm. And it was much of Europe, and then there were a handful of additional countries with 5.2.1 6 weeks later. And so now there could be like a 5.2.2 that only adds this to Canada, or you know, we don't know. But there's 5.3 in beta, which is probably, you know, 6 weeks away. So maybe in 6 weeks, Canada will get the ECG app with a WatchOS 5.3. So if you're in Canada, watch that beta version, maybe. Although I'm not sure, I don't know if it, know if it'd be in the beta or not. But it's the feature certainly went from slow to many more places, because wasn't it the KGI rumor or the Ming-Chi Kuo rumor? That like there's like two watch rumors this year. One is that ceramic returns as a case design material, and the other is that the ECG function works in many more countries.
Yep.
And we had the conversation, which is that through software and regulation, or is it that they upgrade the hardware to meet regulation around the world? And it certainly seems that now the answer is it was just a matter of regulation with the current hardware, because they've hit a number of countries in a short amount of time.
Yeah, it's been expanded dramatically.
Yeah. All right, the next thing is new hardware from Lutron that solves a classic smart home problem for a lighting competitor, Philips Hue. So I love Lutron's HomeKit wall switches, because you replace your light switch on the wall with their wall switch. And they make regular wall switches too, but they make some that work with HomeKit that are called Cassetta. And you physically take off your wall switch and you replace it with this one. The problem is if you don't use Lutron's lighting system, which works with existing bulbs, if you use like Philips Hue smart bulbs, then you have a dumb wall switch and smart bulbs, but you have to keep your wall switch in the on position to be able to control the lights from your voice with like a HomePod, Siri on the iPhone, or the app itself, like on the iPhone. So that's a problem, because people can turn the light off and then you no longer have smart home control for that light. What Lutron has made for Philips Hue through, I think, a program called Friends of Hue, is something called the Aurora Dimmer, which Aurora is like an overused term in like smart lighting, because people have used it before and then removed it, and it's just, it doesn't really say anything. But anyway, Lutron has made a dimmer switch that goes on top of your wall light switch. So the kind that you flick up and down. And it's a knob that rotates left and right to increase and decrease the brightness. It remotely controls the brightness that way. It fixes the light switch to be in the on position, so no one can turn it off by accident. And it's really an elegant solution if it matches like your wall plate. And it's reasonably priced, I think around $40. So yeah, this comes out. Yeah, this comes out next month. You could, you know, if you've got a handful of light switches, you could, for a reasonable amount of money, fix this classic problem of, you know, using Hue bulbs in your ceiling and not having the switch be a problem. I've moved away from Hue bulbs in the ceiling at all, so this no longer applies to me. But for a long time, I would have, we mentioned this podcast, the Hue bulbs in the ceiling, and then the wall switch would be on, or I'd replace the plate so it'd be a blank plate, or I would wire it in such a way that the switch did nothing and you could turn it on and off and it wouldn't do anything. But that wasn't very elegant. This is, you know, people could come visit and know how to control your lights, you know, rotate the knob to turn it up and down. So
yeah, if you don't have smart switches, but you just have Hue lights in the thing, which are, you know, a lot more approachable and a lot easier because you just change the bulb rather than to worry about wiring the wall, you could just put these plates over the top and get the same experience pretty much. It's a good idea.
Yeah, I've changed the wall switches with Lutron, and it doesn't take long once you learn how to do it. But the first time I did that, it took me quite a while, you know, with research. And also, it seems like there are so many variables in the wiring that, like, every light switch can be different. And I always do a thing, because I usually rent, is take a picture of how it is before I change it, and then I can hopefully return it that way if I need to. And that's worked out for me. But this is way more, you know, approachable. And for, you know, decent price, too. And then finally today, Apple announced the keynote for WWDC, which is always the first day, the first like hour of the, you know, the WWDC week. But they do the thing where they invite press to WWDC, and we know that there's going to be a keynote, and they say officially they're going to live stream it. So I'll be in town for that. I won't be in the keynote yet, as far as I know, but I'll be in town. I'll be covering, you know, we'll all cover it in N5 Mac. But also, there's a few things around the community that are fun to do, like all the live podcasts. So I'll be there for, if not all of those, most of those. And I'll also be at the, there's an unofficial WWDC run that happens. So, if not every day, on most days, I'm going to try to go to that too. And what it is people just gather and they run a 5K path in San Jose. So if you go there, I will probably be there. So say hello. I've also ordered 9to5 Mac stickers. I will have 50. Ooh. Yeah. So if you see me, say hi, and I will, you know, if you ask for a sticker, I'll give you one, because I should have enough to hand out to people. And then also we got the WWDC app update today. Last year it was that there was the keynote announcement, and then 1 week later there was the app update. And this year the two things happened in sync. What's new in the app this year?
Not much. Normally they like revamp it quite a lot to match like the color scheme of the show, but this year's app is very similar to last year's. There's a few little things, and they've added multiple app icon options. So the UI of like inside the app is unchanged. It's still white and gray or whatever. But the home screen app icon is dark because the WWDC conference materials are all dark, but you get multiple choices, so you can pick from like blue, pink, yellow, light blue, dark blue.
Yeah, it carries the neon theme on the icon, and that's it. The app itself is unchanged inside, and you do get multiple colors for the neon icon, so that's neat. It's the first time you've done multiple icons.
And obviously they always redact like the session schedule, so you don't, you know, you can't see, it doesn't say iOS 13 anywhere. But they actually messed up on the health one. So there's one about health that hasn't been redacted, at least as we're recording now. And it actually mentions hearing health data, which obviously we covered in the Bloomberg report a few weeks ago. So it's kind of funny they actually forgot to hide one of the announcements.
Yeah. And there's also the I think last year was the first time they added stickers, like iMessage stickers, as part of the WWDC app. And this year they've got new stickers, and they animate like the activity stickers do. And they also have that neon theme to match the kind of theme of the event. So a new WWDC app, check that out. Well, that's the Happy Hour podcast for this week. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Apollo Zach. Benjamin, you are?
BZAMAO.
And also follow 9to5Mac on Twitter and Instagram. If you have any feedback, you can email us at happyhour@9to5mac.com. And we'll be back next week. Bye, everybody.
Bye.